Thanks for coming out to Blue Stockings tonight. For those of you who don't know, Blue Stockings is a collectively owned, volunteer-powered bookstore, cafe, and activist center. We have events nearly every night of the week, and you can sign up for our events email list up at the counter. Our events are a sliding scale donation of $5, but anything you can give helps to keep us open, or you can support us by buying books. And I'll pass that around in a minute. Wayne Price has long participated in the anti-war labor human rights movements. Politically, he went from anarchist pacifism to dissident Trotskyism to revolutionary anarchism, while also influenced by libertarian Marxism. A member of the NYCNEFAC, the Northeastern Federation of Anarchist Communists, he writes regularly for anarchismo.net, for The Utopian, and for Northeastern Anarchists. He has previously published The Abolition of the State, Anarchist and Marxist Perspectives, and we have that at the counter. So please join me in welcoming Wayne Price.
This is the book she mentioned that I had previously written, The Abolition of the State, Anarchist and Marxist Perspectives. And this is the book that I'm currently giving a background to, Anarchism and Socialism, Reformism or Revolution. About the time of Jesus, a Gentile went to the Rabbi Hillel and said, I will convert if you can explain to me the basis of Judaism while I stand on one leg. And instead of throwing him out, the rabbi said, gave him a version of the golden rule. What is hateful unto you, do not do unto others. That is the law, the Torah. All the rest is commentary. And somebody came to me, my comrades, and asked, what is your anarchism? What do you mean? What is the basis of your politics? Can you explain in the time it takes me to stand on one leg? I would say the basic idea is the anarchist revolution. The international revolution of the working class and his allies to establish a libertarian socialist society throughout the world. That's the law, and all the rest is law, quotes. All the rest is commentary. Now, how did I come to this really quite minority position? Not here in this room, of course, but certainly out there, even now with the growth of interest in anarchism. I started out as a liberal child raised by my liberal parents who had friends who were former communists. And there was a period of the Vietnam War and the civil rights struggle, the March on Washington and so on, I observed at least on television. And then one day, in the beginning of high school, when I was away at a Hebrew youth work camp, I ran into the writings of Paul Goodman and Dwight MacDonald. I don't know if these names mean very much to people now, but back then, Paul Goodman particularly was the most well-known anarchist on the left. And in fact, I have a chapter on Goodman in here. They argued that it was possible, that it was necessary to create a society based on face-to-face democracy, on community, on human size and human relationships, that there was a better way for human beings to relate to each other, to live and to work together. And not only that, but they argued that this was not only conceivable, but was actually technologically possible, which was, of course, the first thing I wondered, is this possible? And they gave all kinds of analyses of why it was possible. Also, in the writings of Lewis Mumford, the bioregionalist, who also argued this on at the time. And so I became an anarchist pacifist, following their beliefs. I'm still proud of having been given out one of the first leaflets against the Vietnam War, way back when, from a small group that was organized by David McReynolds and the War Resistance League at the time. And so this was good, and the basic concept of decentralization or decentralized federalism stay with me to this day. I believe it. On the other hand, back in high school, in college where I joined SDS, I got involved in the anti-war movement, and I ran into this Trotskyist organizer. And he argued, first, that pacifism really wouldn't work. It was necessary to have a revolution, and you couldn't have a revolution through pacifism, because, first of all, it wouldn't work against nonviolence wouldn't work against a really, totally committed evil enemy, such as the Nazis, for example, or if the Japanese had invaded at that time and invaded India. And secondly, he argued that there were some conflicts that were so basic that they had to be fought through. Either the working class took power, or the capitalists maintained their wealth and their power. There really wasn't any compromise about it. And either one side won or the other, so one side lost. It had to be that way, which made it very difficult to look at it through the eyes of a pacifist. And at the same time, he gave me some literature on the Hungarian Revolution in 1956, with the counting of the workers' councils that almost took power and that fought against the Russian invasion, and literature from the Trotskyist point of view on the Spanish Revolution in the 1930s. And this literature argued that in every revolution, in every upheaval, bless you, throughout history, or at least in the last 100 years or so, people threw up councils, assemblies, Soviets, shuras, neighborhood assemblies or workplace councils and committees, and this was a pretty consistent thing, going really back, actually, you think of the American Revolution or the British Revolution. And that what should be done was to federate, or at least, no, to him, to associate these councils and committees together as an alternative both to the fascists or totalitarian states of either the Stalinists or the fascists as in Spain, or the Stalinists as in the Soviet Union, and as an alternative to the liberal democratic state that we live under. And I thought, hey, I'm for that. And in fact, I still am for that. I just wouldn't call it what he called it, which is that a worker state or dictatorship of proletariat. And I think of it in terms of federating councils and committees together as horizontally as possible, rather than establishing a bureaucratic, socially alienated machine over and against the rest of society. And for this reason, for example, I argue, even among anarchists, that we should be in favor of saying that we want ordinary working people to take power, but not to take state power, not to establish a new state. But on the other hand, the idea that we should make an effort to take power, that is, to take over society, to disarm the ruling class and smash their state and dismantle all the capitalist institutions and build a new society, that's power. That's power, and that has to be done. And that doesn't mean establishing a state, as ultimately the Trotskyists and certainly all the Stalinists and the liberals and everybody else believes. So I became a Trotskyist, although much to the dismay of this Trotskyist, I did not join his orthodox tendency. You see, there probably you all know there's two main tendencies in Trotskyism. One, the orthodox tendency that accepts Trotsky's theory that the Soviet Union, even under Stalin, was some kind of worker state, a degenerated worker state, whatever. And the other side, the other wing of Trotskyism that rejects Trotsky's theory on that, thinking that there's the bureaucracy became a new ruling class and either established some kind of capitalism or a new kind of society, a bureaucratic collectivism, essentially the same as what the paraconists call coordinatorism, whatever. And he explained his theory. You see that first the workers took power in Russia, and then the workers lost power in Russia, but they had established a state which had nationalized the property, and therefore the property was still working class, and therefore the state was still working class. And then when that state conquered other countries like Eastern Europe, even though there wasn't any workers' power at all, or workers' revolution, nevertheless, sort of hands-on, by magic, transmitted the original workers taking power. And it was all sort of, you know, like, here's my left ear kind of argument that I thought was absolutely ridiculous. So, as I say, I joined the more unconventional dissident wing of Trotskyism, which made me one of the founders of the International Socialists, which is also whose descendants today are the International Socialist Organization, the ISO, or Solidarity. So, nevertheless, we found the thing I liked about this wing of the Trotskyists was the concepts raised by Hal Draper of the two souls of socialism, socialism from below. The idea that what we want is it's not a minority somehow putting socialism into existence, doing socialism for us, whether from a foreign invader or whether from a working class, say an army really built up with a peasant base, let's say, and bureaucratic centralized organization that imposes its concept on society, but rather the self-organization of masses of people, particularly workers taking over and running, reorganizing society. And I thought, well, I'm for that. And again, I'm still for that. In fact, my earlier quotation from Rabbi Hillel was cited by Hal Draper, the theoretical leader of this tendency, who was saying, quoting Marx's first law, first rule of the Communist International, of the First International, the rule being that the liberation of the working class, the emancipation of the working class is the task of the working class itself, and saying, that's the law, all the rest is commentary. And that also is true. By the other hand, my friends and I found that the IS is a very sloppy organization, unrevolutionary in its politics, pushing hard to create a middle class based third capitalist party. Back then it was the Peace and Freedom Party. Today they push Nader's campaign, who's in the Green Party and stuff like that. Essentially, not really a revolutionary organization, or so we thought. So we left that, and a group of us formed an alternative Trotskyist group called the Revolutionary Socialist League. We thought we were going to be really Trotskyist, except for the stuff about Soviet Union. Trotsky was all wrong on that, we knew. And this may seem strange, a strange path anarchism to go from anarchist pacifism to, you know, trying to be a real Trotsky fervor for Trotskyism to revolutionary anarchism. But actually makes a kind of sense, at least in retrospect. Although sometimes I wonder what the hell I was doing. And the basic point was the belief in not just the working class as a possibility, which is in the United States about 80% of the population, but looking for the most oppressed sections of the working class, where the areas where the working class overlaps with women, oppressed nationalities, young people, groups like tendencies like that. Today we would certainly add gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender people. But that's still the same method, to see how the different forms of oppression intersect with each other, overlap with each other, to hold each other up and find ways to undermine them, rather than the Marxist conception of the class struggle being sort of under everything, and then there all the other stuff is all, you know, sort of on the top is all superstructure. I rather tend my image is sort of like a pile of pickup sticks, or maybe a little fire campfire with everything in a teepee. You know, they're all leaning on each other, and some of the struggles, they're all supporting each other and holding each other up. Some of them are more peripheral than others, perhaps. Others are more, perhaps, central. That is, if you pull them out, you know, more of the whole thing will tend to collapse. So there's a strategy about it. You know, the working class, only the working class as the working class can shut everything down. Just like that, you know, there's no other force that can do that. But other forces have other powers. As we saw in the 60s when the black struggle, the African-American struggle on the one hand, and the struggle of people of color and oppressed nations in the Vietnam on the other, their struggles affected everything, turned the whole society upside down, pushed from below and raised every question. So it's all, but the problem in the 60s was that the post-war boom wasn't over, so that we weren't able enough to get the working class in the motion, the real big, the big levers that could really move the whole of society, the big battalions. So that was part of, you know, the attraction of Trotskyism, as well as the tendency to try to be, to both, what he said, tell the truth to people, that you need a revolution, as opposed to the reformist tendency to sort of merge into whatever struggles are going on, the struggle of the attitude of the opportunist. On the other hand, sectarians, to pull yourself away from everybody else and not get involved in struggles, but to try to both be involved in whatever struggles are going on and at the same time tell the truth about the need for revolution. Not that we did those two things together brilliantly, because we didn't, but we tried. We tried. At a certain point, this became became hard to continue to square the circle, to be both revolutionaries and at the same time to focus on, to put aside, to ignore the authoritarian aspects of Trotskyism. We were particularly influenced by the gay liberation movement as well as the women's movement, not so much for the particular, any particular program, but just the general libertarian atmosphere, the general spirit, which led to, you know, rethinking what we were doing and how we saw the world, and to stop ignoring the authoritarianism. It's all very well to say that Trotsky wanted an association of workers' councils, but we look what actually happened in the Soviet Union and the Russian Revolution. Lenin and Trotsky established a police state. How to explain that? Now, we had a particular problem at the time. It was very, very hard to take a libertarian, democratic perspective on the world as a revolutionary group in the 60s, because everyone who was attracted to a revolutionary alternative, everyone who really hated the establishment, was inspired by the real fights going on against imperialism by Mao in China and Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam and Castro in Cuba, all of whom were dictators, but all of whom were, to a certain extent, really fighting against imperialism. So this had a terrific attraction for people. And it was very difficult to oppose that from any kind of a libertarian, democratic, pro-working class perspective, especially combined with the fact, as I said, that the working class wasn't moving that much in the United States. There were things, there was, by the beginning of the 70s, there were certain mass strikes and wildcats and so on, and black caucuses and unions and so on. But as a whole thing, there certainly was nothing comparable to what happened in 68 in France, where there was virtually, there's a nationwide general strike, sparked first by the students and then spread to the workers. And this impressed some of our people, but, you know, that was over there. And Americans, even radical Americans, tend to be very, have a certain isolationist kind of way of looking at the world. not looking at the world scale. So it was very difficult. You'll notice now that the Soviet Union has collapsed, and the Eastern European puppet states collapsed, and then China has openly become a market economy, which before it was a state capitalism, now it's openly capitalist. Now a lot of Marxism is discredited to a great extent, and people looking for an alternative, and large numbers of people, for the first time in maybe 80 years, are really looking towards anarchism. Not everybody. A lot of people who say in parts of the world who used to look towards Arab nationalism, say, with a socialist tinge, now look to Orthodox Islam, which is not a great outcome, but it's part of the same, you know, disillusionment with the old socialist, state socialist, nationalist kind of concepts. In this case, it's positive. It gives us an opening. It gives us a chance. And it's important because the world has changed. We are now in a greater danger than the world has been in a long time. The international crisis, the basis crisis of capitalism, which caused the decay that went, you know, if you look at the world, you look at the period from World War I, followed by shallow prosperity in the 20s, and then the Great Depression, and then World War II, and in between that, various revolutions, which mostly failed in Europe, and then the rise of fascism and the rise of Stalinism. You know, if you look at that period, you say, if during that period you said to people, we are now in the epic of capitalist decay, we are in imperialism's dead end, lots of people said, yeah, well, that makes sense, obvious. But this was lost after World War II. People got the impression that, well, we have capitalism now, it's got the new golden age and prosperity, it's going to go on forever, and tend to ignore the cause of the prosperity involving such things as the reorganization of world imperialism, the 30, 40 years of defeats that went on at the working class that happened before that, in the period I just mentioned, the robbing from the future, particularly of destruction of the environment, counting that as part of the wealth of society, and the arms expenditures. Imagine society whose ecological, whose economic prosperity is based on building a massive amounts of nuclear weapons. It was really quite a sick kind of system, but it looked prosperous. And that's over. And that's over. It's really been over since 1970, approximately. It's all been downhill since then, and sort of it's a little bit up and a little down, a little up and a little down. And during that time, our friends, the people I knew and I was around, said, this is going to collapse. This can't last. We're going to face a new Great Depression eventually. We're going to face various kinds of major crises. And I sort of felt like somebody, like a geologist, telling people in California, don't build on this area. Someday there's going to be a great earthquake. It'll be the big one. It's going to smash enormous numbers of people and houses and, you know, and they say, well, what's going to happen? Well, I really don't know. Is it going to happen 5 years, 10 years, a century? They don't know. And of course, unlike geological strata, social strata, class strata, societies, groupings, have consciousness and decision-making. And so the possibility of, you know, predicting when things are going to actually happen, when will capitalism collapse? When will there be a great new crisis? When will there be upheavals? We don't know. We can participate in it as best we can, but we can't make hard and fast predictions. And that's also one of the reasons for my rejection of Marxism, is the tendency to make these absolute predictions of what you know is going to definitely going to happen. Like the famous saying that Marxist economists have predicted 10 of the last 3 recessions. So we went back to becoming anarchists, and some of the key ideas and whole aspects of topics which I haven't raised in here the relation between the, I mentioned relationship between the working class and non-class oppressed groups. My belief, I no longer believe in the need for a party and one group that wants to take power. But I do believe that those who are revolutionaries, the minority that believes in an anarchist and a revolutionary, libertarian revolutionary concept, should organize themselves. Organize themselves not so that we should take power, but rather so we can fight for our ideas on other people and fight against the vanguardists who want to take power for themselves. This is not either or. It's not against the self-organization of the mass of people. It's part of the self-organization. Because after all, it doesn't happen that one day everyone gets up, they look at each other and say, yeah, no, we need a revolution. It doesn't work like that. What happens is small groups become persuaded of this, and then larger groups, and then larger groups yet, until you get the very fact that most people don't believe that is why we are in a non-revolutionary situation. And it's important moving towards a revolutionary situation for the minority that sees that to get themselves together to work out their ideas, not necessarily in one group. North America is a very big place, and the possibility that everybody with all the good activists and all everybody with good ideas are all going to be in one single organization seems to be very unlikely. But you should get together with people who agree as much as possible and work together with others wherever we can. So I believe that. Similarly, as I said, I don't believe in a worker state, but I do believe in organizing for people, working people, to take power, to overthrow the system. I don't believe, probably this day, a majority of people calling themselves anarchists believe that it's possible to create a new society by peacefully building an alternate institutions side by side underneath the eaves of capitalism in the state, to build co-ops and print shops and other kinds of and communes and so on, none of which are bad. I'm not against saying don't do that if you want to do that. I live in a cooperative house, for example, but I don't see it as a strategy for overthrowing capitalism. Not to say, I live in a cooperative house and it actually works. We don't even have a hired management. We democratically elect the people and who are in charge of it and so forth. But I assure you, it is no threat to capitalism. And the same thing for the corner cooperative food store. They're good, but it's not an alternative to capitalism. The alternative to capitalism is to build a mass movement, to participate in the building and growing the mass movement. Because anarchism is, one thing that's unique about anarchism is the consistency of our means and our ends. Not that I'm a pacifist, but in the sense that just as we want a self-managed, democratically run mass society, so we need to build, as a way towards that, to build self-managed mass movements, self-managed organizations, to democratize, take over the unions, to have democratic organizations in the communities, the kind of things, to people to take over the factories. Let me finish then by commenting, we're in a bad way, because we know that. We know society's in a bad way. The liberals think that after a while the economy's going to get better and then we'll go back to where we were. Maybe not so great, but it won't be terrible. They are wrong. We are facing disasters. We are facing another economic collapse, even worse. We are facing, at the same time, ecological disasters, the global warming, and other ecological disasters. We are facing the dangers of continuing war, as we see is going on even now. There are more nuclear weapons, are more widespread and less controlled than they were during the Cold War. Think of the dangers of nuclear war. These things are facing all of us. The U.S. ruling class, the most powerful class on the face of the planet, seems to have no idea what to do. They really seem to be incompetent to run this society. If you read the newspaper, headlines in the newspaper, right? I feel like sometimes like I'm on a ship being pulled towards in the middle of a giant river, and in front of us is a rocks, and then is a waterfall. And the officers on the ship say, well, you know, There are rocks in the waterfalls and the smash the ship. So let's turn a little bit to the side. And another group of the officers say, no, 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 don't turn to the side, because, first of all, there really are no rocks. You think the rocks aren't any rocks. And second of all, the reason there's a waterfall is because you're turning to the side. And meanwhile, among the crew, there's this very small number saying, jumping up and down, yelling, no, no, you're all crazy. Turn the boat around, or we're all going to be smashed. But they won't do it, because for whatever reason, the officers don't want to lose their capacity of being officers. So we're facing this kind of disaster, and a danger of their trying to maintain their profitability, a danger of a revived fascist movement in this country. By fascist, I don't just mean bad. Some people, you know, that is widely used on the left, the groups we don't like called fascist. By fascism, I mean specifically political tendencies whose aim or interested in overthrowing bourgeois democracy. Tendencies on the right who want to replace bourgeois democracy. We are already hearing the talk of the Second Amendment remedies, right, of people giving speeches about how we're going to take the guns if this doesn't work, and go to the hills, and so on and so forth. Of course, they all say they're for liberty, just as the Nazis, in a time when the communists and the socialists were popular, the Nazis called themselves socialists, national socialists. Well, today in the United States, you can't go on calling themselves socialists. The fascists call themselves defenders of liberty, because that's what sells to the suckers in the United States. So there are these tendencies, and international tendencies that will continue to cause threats of war and other disasters that are going on. But I say to you that there is a possibility of change. I have lived through, in my life, I'm now 64, in my childhood, I wasn't aware of it, but what was going on, the Chinese Revolution and the Indian independence struggle and the Indonesian independence struggle was going on. Then as I grew up, I was aware of the Cuban Revolution and the overthrowing of fascism in Spain and in Portugal, and the overthrowing of the Shah in Iran, and we know the collapse of the Soviet Union we were talking about before, replacing with a somewhat more democratic system, and the ending of apartheid in South Africa. Now, none of these solved everything. Some places, they may even have been worse than before, if you think of, say, Iran. But I'm just pointing out that in the old system that looked like it was going to last forever, the Shah and the fascists of Spain and so forth, and the Soviet Communist Party's dictatorship, it looked like it was going to be there forever. And now these are gone. And the struggle takes place on a new level, on a new basis. Easy to overlook this, because history moves slowly, very, very slowly, and then all of a sudden it's big bursts. After the 1929 Great Depression broke out, it wasn't until about 1935 that the big strikes began, the sit-in strikes that led to the unionization drive in the United States. The civil rights struggle in the United States beginning in 1955, but that was about 10 years after the end of World War II. The struggle against the war in Vietnam heated up by about 1960, but the first major demonstration against the war in Vietnam didn't take place in 1965, led by SDS. You don't know how long the gap will be. It may be disappointing to say, look at France, massive strikes, the whole damn country. Look at Greece. Look at one point, Europe had about 12 countries at once. Look at the United States. Well, we don't know. The Americans have a history of being, on one hand, relatively politically conservative, and on the other hand, when they get moving, be more violent and more chaotic than anybody else. Partly because of our individualism, settler state background, and so forth and so on. I'm going into that. So, history is not over. It don't just look out the window and say, we ain't never got a revolution here. This chaos, in any case, we don't know for sure what's going to happen. But there's a possibility now for freedom and justice and a new way of people living. Anarchism is not just a good thing. It would be better than this evil. We have an evil society, a vile society. But it's more than that. It's necessary. If we do not have anarchism, we will face destruction. Massive human destruction in war and ecological destruction and economic collapse. So we have a chance now, and I urge everybody not only to read my books, but to also continue to work in the struggle. So what I want to do now is sort of open up for discussion. Think. Yes.
I was wondering how we can reach, talk to people about the positiveness of anarchism when there's like all this Tea Party stuff going on. How we should reach more people who may be in that leaning towards that camp to come to the anarchist camp.
Anybody want to give that a shot? Yes, Bill?
Well, one thing I would say to it is that a lot of the Tea Party folks want small government, less government. In that sense, yeah, okay. We're in agreement. Okay, I'm sorry. In that sense, there's a level of agreement there. On the other hand, I think for the most part, most of the people who are really actively involved in the movement, it's a group of people that I don't think we should have any real serious orientation to. We need to orient toward the most oppressed sections of the working class. For the most part, the Tea Party folks are not that. You know, they're overwhelmingly white. Overwhelmingly white. Reasonably well off.
Yes?
Yeah, I just had kind of a thought of what your thoughts would be of this sort of my assessment of, like, I like the idea of anarchy and everything, but I kind of think, like, it's not going really to the root of the problem, which is that if we're electing and sustaining this incredibly dysfunctional, destructive society and set of rules, that impulse is coming from not just what is society, it's a group of people. So collectively, we are a very sick, damaged, like dysfunctional society. So even if you remove a set of rules or whatever, if it's self-governed, you still have sort of this malady or this whatever the low level of emotional, mental intelligence or whatever, not mental, I meant emotional sort of intelligence going on. So it's like, without kind of addressing that, I don't know that it would be any better to have self-governance or a lack of government if the people in this country, by and large, are dysfunctional in a lot of ways or suffering or in a lot of pain or whatever it is, spiritual, emotional. Like, it's only going to, the health of within, right, is going to be reflected in the outside. So if we're a health, dysfunctional, damaged, hurting on the inside, how is it going to reflect positively on the outside, no matter what system we have? So, like, that's my kind of thought and question.
Okay, let me just briefly, in the previous question. My organization, well, not a member of the Northeastern Federation of Anarchist Communists, or NEFAC. I'm not an official spokesman for that, but my views are generally in their mainstream. We don't try to organize the Tea Party people. If we had enough, maybe we might. We did go to the last, to one of their rallies, and came out a leaflet summarizing the views of Tom Paine and saying, look what Tom Paine really said, and so forth. Mostly we try to get involved in grassroots struggles and union struggles, workplace issues, other issues such as Bill here is involved in the struggle to support Mumia, things like that. It's partly, I think, we will influence, to the extent you build a big movement that offers an alternative, as long as the massive liberals are telling people, go vote for Obama, go work for the liberals, go work for the Democrats, stay in the electoral arena, as long as they do that, it's going to be obviously weak, incapable of solving anything, and offering no answers, and people will look for answers. It's only when we go and we say, no, you aren't going to get anything from the elections. We need to build independent mass movement. The movement of the 60s for civil rights was won not in elections, but through mass so-called civil disobedience, which meant law-breaking, not to mention the rebellion, so-called riots in the North. Right. The struggle against the war had involved mass demonstrations, both peaceful and not so peaceful. The winning of the rights of unions in the 30s involved mass sit-ins and so forth. So really, progress doesn't come through the elections and through relying upon one wing or the other of the ruling class. It comes through independent mass movements, and that's what we argue for. Now, the question is just raised. It's an interesting question because it's really a chicken on the egg question. That is, to what extent does the Sikh society create a tendency among people to be apolitical, to be authoritarian, to be beaten down, and to what extent is it people's own negativity that creates the Sikh society? So the chicken or the egg, because it's dialectical, it goes back and forth, one side supporting the other. I would point out, just as an empirical fact, that there have been revolutions in the past. While they didn't solve everything, they did create greater freedoms and greater advantages, I think, over time, so we know it can happen. I would argue that people are not all one thing. That people aren't just passive and submissive. People are also angry and capable of explosion. That people are capable of fighting for freedom. I want to romanticize the oppressed, who is all of us. But on the other hand, I don't think it's not just you and I are the only ones capable of seeing the possibilities of a better kind of world. And I would say also that anarchism, contrary to large-scale belief, anarchism is not a belief that everybody is capable of being perfect. On the contrary, part of the democratic tradition, the anarchist tradition, says people are not perfect. That's why you can't trust anybody with power over other people. That's why you want as much decentralization and democratization and pluralism and limited representation as possible. Because people are not perfect. Even after a revolution, they're not going to be perfect. People will never be perfect. Hopefully after a revolution, a new society, that we'll be a lot less crazy than we are now. But we'll never be perfect. And the question is not, can we have a society for perfect people, but can we have a society that fits human beings? I think we can. Now, I don't know. Maybe we're doomed. Maybe we're, maybe someday, you know, they'll blow up the world with nuclear bombs and the icebergs will all melt and will, you know, rise 10 feet, the water level will rise 10 feet and, you know, so on and so forth. But I like to, it's not so much a prediction, it's a commitment. It's saying, I'm willing to commit myself to the possibility of the positive sides of human beings, the freedom-loving side, winning out. It's happened to a degree in the past. I think it can happen again, and I'm willing to work towards that. Now, if you want to make a prediction, then it makes more sense to, you know, discuss buying tickets to New Zealand. I don't know if I've answered your question, but that's the best I can do. Yes, brother.
From the way that you've spoken, what I'm gleaning from that is that your group's methodology is to find a movement which is positive and to hook onto it. And you try to hook onto this movement and that movement of various kinds of oppressed groups. And I'm wondering whether you feel, whether I'm expressing it correctly, or whether you feel rather that there's some leadership role that your group can play.
Well, what I would not accept is the notion that his movements or his people struggling, and here are the revolutionary anarchists, and they should hook on something that's going on here. We're part of the population, and we're part of the struggle, and we want to participate in and join in the struggles that affect everybody else as much as possible where we are, in our workplace, in our job, in our neighborhood, in the society we live in our communities. We focus on the evils of the United States rather than the evils of Saudi Arabia or Iraq. Not because there aren't plenty of evils, but because, first of all, the United States is the most powerful country on earth. And secondly, because we're here, we live here. We take some responsibility for it, and we have to fight against it. So I don't see ourselves outside it, hooking up to something else. I mean, if I want to say, where is their struggle, and I want to relate to that, but I'm not taking it over. The question of leadership, we tend to use the phrase leadership of ideas. Yes, we want to tell people, this is what we think. And we have a right to our opinions, just as you have a right to your opinions. And the people who want to believe in the Tea Party or believe that Obama is the savior of humanity and just somehow just won't do it, you know, they have a right to their opinions. And it's not that, you know, we are the vanguard who know the truth, but we have our opinions, you have your opinions, and we want to go and discuss it and argue for our opinions. Because I don't like the idea of, you know, some anarchists say, we shouldn't tell anybody what we think because we don't want to impose our leadership over on people. As though it's all right for the Democrats and Republicans to tell people what they think, but the anarchists should keep quiet. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But that doesn't mean we have a right to talk as well as anybody else does. So I think that's a democratic conception. Yes. Again, yes.
I guess, like, to the average person, like, the concept of anarchy, there's sort of a PR problem. Like, I think most people have no idea what it means besides, like, the stereotype of people destroying. You know, what could be kind of a soundbite of what would be, in your opinion, what would society look like if we had an anarchist revolution?
Right.
What would education, healthcare, all these things, what would that look like, and how could that be described to the average person so that they wouldn't, like, give you a blank, dead-eyed stare when you even suggest such a thing?
Yes, that's true. To most people, anarchism means society just the way it is, but no police people. And they imagine, well, what happened is, you know, the criminals, the antisocial types, will run wild until the mafia takes over and becomes a new state. And interestingly enough, this is pretty much what the so-called Libertarian Party advocates. You know, people sometimes even claim to be anarchists, but are actually pro-capitalists. They are critical of the centralized, bureaucratic, big state, but they're in favor of the centralized, bureaucratic, big capitalists, corporations. My conception, I go into this in both books, particularly the abolition of the state, what would that mean? What do these terms actually mean? Is to replace the bureaucratic centralized state by association, federation of councils, of popular committees, to replace the bureaucratic centralized economy by a network of self-governing associations, in effect consumer cooperatives and producer cooperatives, managing the economy, and to replace the police and the military as separate specialized layers by an armed population, by a popular, what the word militia used to mean, before it came to mean just any kind of a group of fanatics running around. As long as some kind of self-defense is necessary, and armed people prepared to defend ourselves, to patrol our streets and to prepared to defend against foreign invasions. That's my general conception. And it's what I generally tell people, that what we mean by anarchism is the most extreme and consistent democracy. That's what I tell people.
How is an armed population of however many any different than an army or the police?
Because it's not somebody standing over us, enforcing rules on us.
Okay.
Specialists who are our enemies, really, capable of serving to put down people here if they go on strike, or people in other countries if they rebel. It's rather the people themselves deciding themselves associated with their own popular councils and committees, democratically deciding what they want, what they want to do. It's not. It's the way it used to be through most of human history. You know, in ancient Athens, when the assembly, which was only men, voted to go to war, then the citizens went home and took down their armor and sharpened their weapons. They weren't voting to send somebody else to war. And this idea of the specialized military, Rousseau regarded the professional military as the right along with the professional representative politicians as part of the end of democracy. So I think in principle there's a big difference. Anything else? Anyone hasn't spoken? Questions? Arguments? Yes?
I was just going to make a remark. I mean,
please do.
In regards to like anarchist institutions and things of that nature, you know, if you say you want like, you know, a revolutionary change, how do you create space for the movement to exist without establishing those institutions and without introducing like maybe spaces where there's sustainable lifestyles going on? Because to me, you know, if you're talking about like having a true revolution, you need to develop new sustainable ways of living so that you no longer have to rely on the capitalist system to get what you need in order to survive. You can finally step outside of it and build your movement maybe in parallel to it or as a, you know, asymmetrical type of relationship or whatever. But it's kind of hard to see how to do that without, you know, establishing a hierarchical institution or something of that nature.
Well, to some extent I agree. I mean, obviously here we are having this meeting. Instead of renting a hall, we're in a alternate bookstore. And that's a good thing. I'm for alternate bookstores. And Blue Stocking deserves all the credit for building that. And I'm certainly for alternate newspapers and websites and info shops and stuff like that. That also helps get the word out. After all, the bourgeoisie has this massive communication machinery. All we've got is some websites. So we should certainly be using them. So to some degree, I think I agree. On the other hand, I don't think you can really move outside of capitalism. Capitalism, this is the society.
Yeah.
They run the state. They run the elections. One reason why anarchists don't believe in running in elections. And they run the marketplace. And if you build a commune or a co-op, you're in the market. The marketplace, they run the marketplace more than anything else. I mean, this is capitalism, right?
Yeah.
So the idea of an alternate, you know, really doesn't, is kind of limited. It doesn't mean we don't do limited things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I particularly believe in is building alternative institutions of mass struggle. Even the unions, as bureaucratic as they are, we find that historically that places were able to have opposition caucuses or even wildcats were more able to do that places where there were unions. Even though the union itself is bureaucratic,
yeah,
it gave a certain kind of protection. Certainly, I would have been fired many times over if not for my rather bureaucratic and conservative union.
Yeah.
So it gives a certain kind of, these things give a certain kind of space to organize. Extent that they're, in effect, when we're talking about, one reason we prefer bourgeois democracy is because it opens things up for workers' democracy. It opens things up for our, not because we really believe that this means that it isn't the capitalists who run the state. This is still the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. But it opens things up for us. It's convenient for them and it's convenient for us. that it gives us opportunities to put out our little, our newspapers and our organizations and to meet and to discuss. And we need to use that. So there are opportunities there. The more there's a mass movement, as I was saying before, the fact when in the 60s, when there was began with the rebellion of the black struggle, it opened up all of society. It moved everything. And suddenly, where there had been no space, a society that had been everything closed down and controlled through the McCarthyite hysteria, suddenly became open. Then there were campus rebellions. The biggest campus rebellions were usually connected to the black struggle in some way. And then this opened up to people supporting the Vietnamese struggle and opposing U.S. imperialism. And that became known. So now they're scared of this. I suspect that they brought Obama forward to be as sort of a preemptive strike against the rising of the left. Back in the 60s, they got really worried when something like thousands, about a million people, regarded themselves as revolutionaries. And so they ran people like Eugene McCarthy or George McGovern, who would actually say, there's this talk of new parties and leaving the Democrats, so forth. We need to bring our youth home and bring them back into the system. They would say that. That's why they were running. This time, they didn't wait. They knew that there was a lot of discontent. 8 years of George Bush. 8 years of incompetence and bad policies and so forth. They knew the left, so they put forward an African American or a woman as a president. And that let the channel all the discontent into them. Right. And also set us up to be disappointed. Because, of course, these people aren't going to do anything. You know, how many times you read in the liberal media, why won't Obama do such and such? Why won't the Democrats do this and that?
What liberal media?
Well, the Nation, let's say. You know, you're right, not the New York Times or whatever. But even sometimes you see that kind of argument in the Nation. Why won't they do that? And the answer is, the right wing can mobilize their base. That's safe for capitalism. But the Democrats really can't mobilize their base. They can't mobilize workers and African Americans and women to start fighting, to get mad. That's dangerous for the system. Their whole job is to sucker these people into the society and then get them quiet. So the right can mobilize under the Republicans, but the Democrats dare not mobilize a mass struggle, and therefore they always capitulate to the Republicans. So all this is, but the good sign of the last election was that lots of people are becoming, not demoralized, that's not so good, but disillusioned. And out of that disillusion may come, in the basis of a new mass radicalization. Is anybody else? Then, yes.
Knowing the history at the end of the First International, can you...
You're really going back now, yes.
Well, it had to do...
Neither of us is that old.
The friction between the communists and the anarchists.
Yeah.
And so what I want to know is, how do you remarry this divorced couple?
Well, as I say, I'm not so committed to the actual disputes of 200 years ago. I happen to think that on many key questions, the anarchists were basically right. There really one key political question back in the First International was whether to channel the movement into electoralism. And I think that history has shown that Marx was wrong and the anarchists were right to oppose that. On the other hand, I think Marx's economic analysis is pretty good. At least that's my opinion. And it's possible, as I was saying, to be an anarchist and still say, well, I like Marx's economic analysis, but then there are these libertarian Marxist tendencies of essentially the same politics as anarchists. So I don't have to choose there. And I can agree with the need for a revolutionary group to organize itself without believing in a vanguard party. And I can believe in the working people taking power without believing in a new state. So that's how I try to, I don't have to choose. I can accept an anarchist perspective while learning from Marxism. Yes, you wanted to say something again.
Oh, I was wondering, what place is there in an anarchist society for, like, extreme right-wingers, the Tea Partiers, like, fundamentalist religious people? A large percentage of the American population thinks that the rapture is coming, that, I mean, it's scary, but where, I don't understand how everyone just wouldn't kill each other. Like, are they just to be killed off? I don't know, how would they survive in that kind of system? Like, how would things... It's almost, like, idealistic to the point of delusion. Like, I don't know how, without checks and balances, how would we not... We're already, like, on the precipice of some sort of, like, craziness, right? So, like, take away... I just can't envision how we could have those diametrically opposed, not even in reality, people that have this worldview. How would they deal with it? They would have their own revolution, I guess, and kill us.
Well, to some extent, they would like to have their own revolution and do away with all of us. If you question that on May 21st, 2011, that God will be here, then that is the rapture, as the people in Penn Station say. You're the devil. But in any case, more seriously, to some extent, a lot of those folks, the less crazy ones, will, divide themselves out. They will become isolated. And they may well change their opinion. One of my stories, Farrell Dobbs, who led the 1934 Teamster strike in Minneapolis, general strike, shut down the whole city for several days and won. Less than 2 years before, he voted for Herbert Hoover for president as opposed to Roosevelt. So you've got a lot of these people who, they're in flux. This may include some of the Tea Party folks, too. That starts out with, they all believe in the market. The problem is that, I'm not getting bailed out of my house, but they're bailing out these gigantic banks and other corporations.
True.
Which is all true. Santelli and some others, kind of a little sleight of hand and got that turned around into... blaming other working class people to the extent that working class people in the Tea Party to begin with. But in any case, a lot of those folks, it's in flux. They may well join us. To the extent they do join us and actually, if they oppose us, with their Second Amendment stuff, we got to defend ourselves. I'm not out to just kill them. If they want to be fundamentalist Christians and so forth, I have no problem with that in an anarchist society. But please don't impose that on everybody else.
Yeah, it's on the one hand, your assumption isn't fair because at a point where there's a revolution, we've got to assume that vast numbers of people will believe in the need for a revolution, will be on our side. Now, how will that come down? It could be fairly nonviolent, if you consider about 80% or so of the people are, work for a living and aren't supervisors and get salaries or wages. And if you consider that the military is composed essentially of the sons and daughters of the working class. So it could be fairly nonviolent. On the other hand, the United States has this history of great violence, has massive amount of hatred and racism and sexism and arm yourself kind of a tradition. And it could be very violent. We don't know. It's, I think, less likely to be violent the more that the good guys are prepared to struggle all the way. If they know we're not going to give in. the more your, as you, the whole discussion I mentioned before between Obama and the right wing, they think they can get away with it, they will get away with it. The history of the Nazis versus the socialists in Germany. As much as possible, we want to say we believe in freedom. We certainly believe in freedom of religion. We are the freedom lovers. And we're certainly open to anybody participating with us in a society, as long as you don't take up arms against the commune, the federation of councils. As long as you work with us, or at least are neutral, that's fine. It's only if you take up arms against us and try to shoot at us will we have to suppress you. As I said, I don't know how it'll work out. Maybe we may have to bring in an army from Mexico to help us out. Can't say. I hope it'll be as peaceful and as nonviolent as possible. Because, like most people, I hate violence. But also, like most people, I'm not an absolute pacifist. Any other questions? Anybody else who's anybody who hasn't spoken yet? Well, in that case, I'll point out again, there's two books. This, the one on the abolition of the state, Anarchist and Marxist Perspective, goes into a lot of things that we've been talking about what it actually means, what both Marx and what both the anarchists meant by abolishing the state, which usually is here as a vague phrase, what would take its place. This is more of a collection of essays I've written over the years, and it's just sort of repolished and give certain basic concepts. What is anarchist communism, for example? Whole analysis. What was the Soviet Union? What does that tell us about what we mean by socialism? And we're also selling, we also have the magazine, The Utopian, which some of my friends put out, includes an essay by me on the relation between Trotskyism and anarchism. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.